My name's Laura and I'm an alcoholic. And I am prepared to cry, so prepare yourself. let's see. I believe that I was, if not born an alcoholic, I believe that I was introduced to that because in 1960, they put beer in my baby bottle. Now, I don't think I was that much of a hungry child. I think that they just were trying to keep me shut up and asleep. So I'm sure I acquired the taste for alcohol about that time. When I was four, we would go to town for parts when my dad broke down on the ranch, and he would buy me a quart of Coors, or Budweiser and him a quart of Coors, and we put it in the irrigation ditch. And I definitely know I liked the taste of alcohol then. And what my story is I knew the difference between Budweiser and Atkins. Through the years, my dad really didn't drink that much, but I did have occasion around one of my uncles to drink a little bit. My mother, who had a lot of mental health issues, was on a regular basis going to Amarillo, Texas to have therapy. And about every 3 years, they would put her in a sanitarium, give her shock therapy, and put her on a different kind of drug. So pills never really became my issue because I had seen the insanity, true insanity with it with my mother. Now, I'm not going to say I didn't take any, but I didn't get locked in the pills. My drug of choice was tequila, and enough said there. Waking up in jail, waking up naked, waking up 2 or 3 days later. my background is I'm a farmer's daughter, and my experience with being a workaholic really came into play whenever I got sober. That's a whole other part of the story. But my learning how to escape my feelings was something that was crucial to my survival. Being abused on a regular basis, my mother's insanity was very violent. And I learned how to hide those feelings and escape and even hide the physical damage. And it kept me okay. And I really believe that coming into recovery was what saved my life as far as my mental health issues as well. Maybe more on the side of emotional health now that I'm in my 40s. anyway, my drinking really kicked into gear when I was 16. I was a regular over here on this corner bar. It's called El Presidente now. It was Flintstones back then. And when I was 16 years old, I was a regular at that bar. The only night we didn't go was Monday night, and that's because it was closed. And I had that ability because I've always looked older. I'm really not that old. I just have gray hair. But I was partying with hairdressers because I was going to beauty school my junior and senior year in high school. And I was riding with bikers. You know they're crazy bucks. Even sober. And the opportunity for the other addictions that multiplied during that time as well. Some of those came up more in my recovery as well. But I have been clean and sober for 25 motherfucking years. As of Sunday. Excuse me, F-bomb. It'll happen again. My last drink was on the 13th of March. Approximately 6:30 p.m., it was a Tuesday, and it was a half a Michelob Light because I was trying to control my drinking by that time. And I was going to Circe's, which was another place I drank at often, because they drank like I did. And then I'd take them home, and then I'd go back and finish drinking. And that's how I got a few of my DUIs. There was a lot more DUIs that I should have got, but I didn't. I went through about 8 vehicles from 16 to 23. Two of my DUIs were in a 59 Dodge pickup made out of metal. One of them was an accident, hit and run. I was in a blackout. 2 hours after the incident, my blood alcohol was 0.29. That was I was 21. I was legal to be drinking. I weighed about 100 pounds soaking wet, and I got a lecture from the judge, who years later I met at an AA meeting, sitting right next to me. I guess he washed down pills with Dr. Pepper. but I kind of make that point because my tolerance at 21 years old was extreme. And I, on that DUI that I got the first time, I had made plans. I was staying at a friend's house, I was in the van, gave my keys, and a week or so after I got out of jail, I asked him what happened, why I didn't give him my keys back, and he said, I was afraid you was going to hurt me, Laura. And I really don't know what that means. I was little. Come on. Maybe it was the tequila. But I drove some people off the road, completely off the road, and then hit them. Got back on the road and kept going. And then at some point decided in my blackout to just stop. And was sitting there in the road. I remember sort of out of the blackout, the hand that came in to get the keys out of my ignition, you know, because that was violating my space. And I remember the cop's badge that they had called that as I stepped out of the truck. It was kind of high, and there's a couple of steps. And I remember the cop's badge. Seriously, I still visualize the cop's badge hitting my face as I fell on his chest, stepping out of the truck. They drove my truck home, parked it for me. It was out on Riggin Road, and I lived down on 324 or 328, whatever. They took the truck out there, and I remember sitting in the back seat because I had dogs. My dogs already partied with me, you know. They even went to the bars with me. But they took me in the truck and the dogs home, and then they took me to jail. But the cop that was driving my truck kept saying something must have happened in the accident because he couldn't keep it on the road. And it had big wide tires, big rims that kept breaking spindles and hubs. But it looked good, you know. And I looked good in it. And it had a power steering, they said, was from Canada, and it had a couple of teeth missing. So when it was kind of slow and the big, you know, the whole combination, it kind of did this on the road. And I found the drunker I got and the faster I drove, it was easier. It didn't go quite so hard. So the big steering wheel, and when it was slow, you'd drive like this to keep it straight. And I'm not kidding. And then the drunker and the faster, and it got like this. But if it hit a divot in the road, it would shoot off, you know, because the front end, the most, anyway. And that truck, as insane as it was for me to drive that, as drunk as I was on a regular basis, because that was really my worst, it really did keep me alive a lot of times. Even when it would drive off the road, because it did it, I didn't. It would drive off the road into that alfalfa field, out a few bars out in Tulare there were near alfalfa fields. So when you drunk drive away from them, I would drive off in the alfalfa field, and you know the little whoop-de-doo rims that they held the water in? Well, about, and then it would shoot me out of the truck. The truck would stop, and I'd get up and pick up whatever fell out and climb back in and drive back on the road and keep going. That was normal. So when I got to my step two of the insanity of my drinking, I didn't have much problem there because I was insane. My drunk driving was insane, but I did it on a regular basis. And I learned early on how to maintain my buzz because when I was partying with the hairdressers and bikers, the big house by the cemetery, we all partied every night. My family would let me go there and pick me up. And as long as I was, you know, staying under control, it was okay. And I think today that was my dad trying to kind of overcompensate and make up for the insanity on the other side of it. So I was allowed to do things like that as long as we stayed safe. He had no clue what I was doing, really. But my disease of alcoholism was out of control. Clearly by the time I was 20. When I was 19, I drove my car into a telephone pole and did the steering wheel in half of my face. I still have a scar to evidence that. And that really was an alcohol. I had two beers, little 12-ounce cans. But it was, at the risk of getting in trouble here, red cents, hash, and cocaine in a joint that you stick in the microwave. Because back then, in 79, the microwaves were fairly new, and you really didn't have a lot of things you could cook in other than a Cocoa Puff. And I only had two of those. And I lived 17 miles out in the country. 2 miles of it was dirt road, and in the wintertime, mud road. And they said I probably saw phantom pheasants or something, but I just was going fast and over the creek and into the telephone pole I went. And the next morning, because I was 19 years old, the next morning my cure for that was when my face was swollen and my lip was like this, and I had literally ripped my chin away from my jawbone. I was drinking Erlinger beer. That's something better. I was drinking Erlinger beer, taking codeine, and smoking L through a straw because my face was so swollen. And I found as long as I stayed sitting up, the Erlinger beer and the codeine was good. If I leaned a little bit, it would knock me out. So I would stay sitting up, and it worked real well for me. And that was on Thanksgiving Day because I was celebrating Thanksgiving. A little more special occasion. But, you know, it was alcohol involved because I did have two Budweisers. And I will mention here, I didn't find out until after I got sober that if I had stopped drinking Budweiser earlier, I wouldn't have continued to have the Budweiser shits. So if any of you that drink Budweiser and wonder why you always have the shits, it's because of the Budweiser. I found that out in recovery. Staying hydrated and drinking Budweiser, still, you're going to have that little problem. And that's one of those things we should put in this new big book about controlling your drinking and the different methods that you try. But my story as far as getting into recovery was completely because of my DUIs. I had three on paper, 2.9, 2.7, and 2.4 on my blood alcohol levels. And if you're in the DUI club, you know what that means. If you're not, don't ever be. To survive that kind of insanity, God had a different purpose for me. But when I got to recovery, the person that I asked to help me was my DUI counselor. He was an honoring motherfucker, excuse the F-word again, because he was. When he'd go on a 12-step call, he would go in with somebody else. He's the one that would shut the door, and he would put his chair in front of the door, because if you called him out and talked about wanting to get sober, you wouldn't listen. And he would park his chair in front of the door, and you listened. And yet, he was the one that I called when I needed help, and he told me that not whatever I did, don't drink that night. So I went right to seriously and had that last beer, you know. But my experience, as far as getting any kind of, my first contact with AA was really kind of weird. That first DUI I got, I was told by the judge that, you know, took the pills with Dr. Pepper, that I needed to go to AA. So he made me go to 12 AA meetings, and back in 1982, a DUI was like a speeding ticket or you ran a red light. You went to traffic school is all you did. Three little classes for $25, and you were done. So he made me go to 12 AA meetings. So I went to one, because, you know, I really do want to try to do it right, even when I was drinking. The other 11 I signed at the bar on Searcy's. We ran it down the bar and everybody signed it. And I turned it in. But the first one I did go, I was on it. And luckily they pay closer attention to the signatures now. But this lady was sitting there, I think she was 18 years old, talking about how she got her apartment. She just, you know, it was at Pine. It was upstairs in that long room. That's where they had the women's meeting on Monday night. And she talked about how she had put her life together and she had a job and an apartment and was happy and proud of herself. You know, and I was sitting there to myself thinking, I got all that shit. Who cares? You know, so what? And this lady next to me started talking, And she was really an older lady and very well kept. You know, she was a fufu lady. And apparently kind of important there, but I didn't know that till later. And she was talking about, she was like lady like that. She was talking about, well, back in the 80s, it cost a lot of money for those. Oh, sorry. but she was talking about getting real, and I remember in my insanity, looking at her and her talking about getting real and all of that appearance of what a lady's supposed to look like, her false eyelash had dropped down and was stuck to her cheek. And I was already judging the girl that was 18 and coming out of rehab getting her life together, and I'm looking at her talking about getting real with all her fake shit and her eyelash, and I got kind of tripping on her trying to pull it, while she's talking, trying to pull it loose from her cheek, and I didn't have a real good taste for A because of that. I was just blaming her, you know. But apparently she was a great monarch in the recovery community. I found out later. But I continued to drink. When they told me, when I got sentenced at that DUI that time, my first DUI, they told me that I needed to go to rehab. And at that time I had jobs, animals, you know, I had a lot of responsibilities. I just couldn't afford to go to rehab. Had too much to lose if I went to rehab. So the second year when I got another DUI, they told me again I probably had to go to rehab, and I still had some stuff left. But I drank every day for 8 years. I was drinking with whoever could keep up with me. I usually drank with older people who drank for 40-something years, and some of them are still sitting up here. She's drinking, if they lived. But my experience, when I was going through all those, because the second year of my second DUI, I was ordered to DUI school. Excuse me, I like to call it program now. I was ordered to DUI school, and I flunked school, because I got another DUI while I was going to DUI school. And they were trying to teach me how to do it responsibly. And they still do. They still try to teach you how to do it responsibly. Don't let friends drink and drive and all that stuff. But my first experience was giving somebody my keys, and, you know, that almost got somebody else killed. So there's a lot of things, basically, that really don't work when it comes to that. Going to DUI school for the year. I was doing weekends, doing my alternative services for the jail. Sweeping parking lots and picking up cigarette butts that whole year of 1983, and the money to do it so I could still work and drink. And the job that I held, by the way, maintained my alcoholism. I'll get into that later. But the lady that took us out on the weekends that worked for the sheriff's department would sell us a bag, a little brown paper bag of skunkweed, they called it back then. Not the skunkweed you have now, but for $10. The lady that was driving us around that worked for the sheriff's department. Did you miss that part? So my year of consequences, I didn't take real serious. Going to the DUI school, I really don't remember much. It's hard to not drink and go to court. It's hard to not drink and go to the school. It's hard to not drink and come to these fucking meetings. You know? And I experienced something just Monday night. You know, some guys coming into a meeting, newcomers, and if there's anybody here that was at that meeting, I hope that I don't offend you, but I was appalled at the no-timer that told these guys to shut up or get out. Absolutely blew my mind. The newcomers are the ones that are important. Just so you know, you are the most important in this room. Anyway, I got sidetracked there. And I'm angry still. To hear an old timer with 19 years clean and sober tell a dude I'm going to use the fight out is insane. Because it saved my life. And they put up with my ass when I got here. They put up with my insanity. And they put up with my humor. It appalls me to know that that person then brought up the topic of faith, you know. Anyway, believe it, if you're in your first year or two of recovery, you are the most important person here. because sitting here with my 25 motherfucking years clean and sober, there's some pieces of that that I forgot what it feels like to be so desperate for life and recovery. You get comfortable. You get safe. You get peaceful and you get serene. You get all those promises. You absolutely do get all those promises. You can trust that. But you got to work for them. And the most important job in recovery is just don't drink. Even if your ass falls off, just don't drink. That stuff that you hear around meetings and the things that people do is what people do. When I reached out for help with that crotchety old DUI counselor, I really was desperate. And my motivation that time when I asked, because I'd gotten another DUI, and I was driving down Mooney Boulevard, it was just another day for me then. My 0.24 alcohol, it was just another day. That's how bad I was at that point. But I didn't want to go to jail and have to detox in jail. I didn't want to have that experience of, you know, puking and shitting on myself, because I knew it was going to be bad. I shook for a week. I had the tremors for a week and when I stopped drinking. Luckily, I had about 3 weeks in the Pine, at that time it was Pine Manor, before I went to jail. So I was able to shake the worst of the demons off before I went in. And I did go to jail sober, which was my greatest fear. I don't want to go to jail. I want to go to jail. You know, so I drank over not going to jail, and then I went to jail sober. Best thing that ever happened to me. Because it set me still long enough to get my head out of my ass and listen. I got just a little flash in the pan at recovery while I was in rehab there. Because they make you go to meetings every day. They make you mop the floor. You'll die. At that time, they made us drink decaf coffee. At that time when I hit recovery, they made us sit with the hairy-legged boys in the living room and watch TV. Because we were still co-ed there at Pine. And they did make us, because we didn't want to go over there. We wanted to sit in our own little room because we had our own little TV set for Sober Station. And they told us we had to go sit in there with the boys and learn how to participate in life and all that. And apparently what happened while I was gone, some of the girls and boys were participating in other things behind the woodpile and in the walk-in downstairs. And they decided to give them their own house. A couple blocks away. And I'm sure things are a lot different. I did experience a lot of my recovery, early recovery, at the recovery homes, because that was my safe place. To this day, if I need a quick check-in to make sure that I'm okay, just to kind of like driving by the old homestead, I drive by fine. Usually when I drive by, I see all the chairs up on the tables because they still have to clean that goddamn place. That was a major part of what helped people get recovery was paying attention to the details, because when they walk around the rehab with that white glove on, checking to see if you did your tour right, it's really spiritual. It really is good for you. Because when you're grown up in recovery, if you ever think about drinking and using and happen to go back to rehab, you'll remember that white glove is part of rehab. And it really is. It's important to learn how to live your life. My use was I was spinning out of control, and I didn't have any way out. I really didn't. There was nobody in my life that was like, you know, maybe I ought to slow down. I had some drunk lady one time at Flintstones when I was about 16 or 17 said, maybe you have an allergy to alcohol. I was like, no, works fine for me. I don't sneeze. But, you know, if she'd explained it more, maybe I'd understood. But I was like, it doesn't give me a runny nose and I don't sneeze. And if somebody had just said something, maybe I could have not done all the damage to my life that I did, but I destroyed everything. And when I lost everything, I still had about 8 or 9 months left in me, homeless. And I did have my pickup, so I could at times sleep in the pickup. But my last few months of my drinking and using, I was homeless. And I remember not having anything to eat but some mashed potatoes. And if you mix them up, because all I had was water, you mix up mashed potatoes with water and you have a little bit of mustard packets, give it a little flavor, you know, it works. And I was actually doing pretty good for somebody who only had at least mashed potatoes and a way to have hot water, you know? And to this day, that having survived that does have an effect, because I'm not going to go hungry, as you can tell. I'm not going to go hungry. And I do remember when I got out of jail and back to rehab, because I asked to go back to rehab. I wasn't done yet. So I walked with my little brown paper bag back up to Pine to finish my recovery. When people asked me, how long are you going to stay? My answer was, as long as it takes. And I meant that, and that's what I did. I stayed as long as it took. And have not relapsed. I am one of the few that I hear, and people that relapse scare the hell out of me, because it's that easy. It would be that easy for me. But my 25 years, when I hit recovery, I haven't relapsed yet. And it's because I took it serious. And it's because, as insane as I was, my life does depend on it. If I do drink or use, I will be, either way they say, it's like you never stopped. When you start again, it's like you never stopped. Or the other one where it's like, you know, you pick up right where you left off. Either one of those are kind of bad for me, so I don't want to go back to that. And you can survive anything in recovery. You really can. Because the family that you will learn to trust in rehab and recovery, there's a stronger connection to those people, a love connection, because, ooh, watch out. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart. And that's one of the reasons why it upsets me so much about that asswipe that said that to that guy in that meeting. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart, and those people did not hear that Monday night from that guy. There is something else I want to share. That there's somebody sitting in this room that helped me find recovery in as far as my spiritual connection. And he probably doesn't have a clue what I'm talking about and won't remember it at all, I'm sure, it was because it's a very humble individual. But I was talking about God because I was scared of God, and not because I had any, you know, religious history in that, just that, you know, God was, you know, from what other people said, was kind of scary. And I knew that when they were talking about doing the 12 steps, they said God a lot. And through the years of my recovery, people have tried to change that, and luckily they haven't yet. God's still in there. And he still works there. But they told me that I had to get spiritual and I had to get God. And so, because I was one of those that believed in the tree, you know, and all that, something nature and all that stuff. I lived in Yosemite part of my youth, and because it was fun and it was easy. But he said to me, if you want to know God, just ask him to reveal himself to you. And we were sitting at a table at the Alana Club over on Santa Fe, and I remember the fear that if I do that, you know he will do that. If I ask God to reveal himself to me, he's going to. So I knew that, at least my experience at that point, my spiritual experience at that point was I trusted that. So then I chewed on that for a while, and during the first 5 years of my recovery, I was driving a John Deere tractor most of the time. I got lucky. Caterpillar, anyway, I was farming. And so I sit out there for 10, 12, 15 hours on that tractor, and I think about, you know, I'm not ready yet to ask him, but I know if I do, he will. And it worked. I did finally get to the point where I felt safe enough to ask God into my life. And God, Leroy, or Diana, whoever you believe in, believe in them. Believe in them, because if you only believe in yourself, you're going to die. You're going to use them. I've seen too many people that can't let go and get outside of themselves. Find out that there's a power just a little bit greater than you are. Get your head out of your ass and make a commitment to recovery, because living that life like that, you don't have to do that. You really don't. You can be just as insane in sobriety. You can't blame alcohol and drugs for it, because when you remove the alcohol and drugs, you're still you. The first thing I am and the first thing that my sponsor made me have to own up to was the fact that I was a human being first. And I didn't want to be that in early recovery, because that made me like all you son of a bitches. And I didn't want to be like you son of a bitches, because you're selfish, you're self-centered, and it was like, oop, that's me. So I finally learned that I could give into that. And that is the basis of tying into to the program, that you are human and you're like us. But being human, and whoops, make that mistake and relapse, you don't have to relapse. You just don't. hang on to your ass, and then hang on to somebody else's ass. You pick up a new addiction. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, there's things you can delete. But work the steps, live the steps, believe the steps, trust them. The steps are how I finally got some discipline in my life. And going to rehab was the only way for me to get clean and sober, because I had done it on my own. I had the pride and the ego, besides being a Leo, that I could do it on my own. I made my life and I destroyed my life all on my own. And then I found out that I could let go of the drugs and the alcohol, and I could still be as selfish and self-centered and just make as many... My story in recovery is insane, because I stepped outside of myself and I got into God, and I believed that if you didn't do it the AA way, you were going to die. And I believed that for quite a few years of my recovery. And if you didn't go to meetings and you didn't trust God, clean your house, go to meetings, read the book, and call your sponsor, you're going to die. And there's so many people that did die. And in this point in my recovery, I keep myself back a little bit. I don't get as close because you're going to die. Well, I've learned that I can let people in my life because God put them there. Whoever crosses my path, God wants them to be there. Whoever God puts me in their path, He wants me there. And everything happens for a reason. I totally believe that. At this point in my life, I've retired from a profession that I was able to do because of my recovery. And I'm now working in a place that I'm able to share my experience, strength, and hope with people that don't care. They don't care whether I'm sober or not. They have an experience of making poor choices, making mistakes on a regular basis. And I can share with them what it's like to be real, like that lady with the eyelash, and be in recovery and make a commitment to yourself. A lot of those people have had the accidents and killed people in DUI-related incidents. And I will not treat them any differently than the person who just, chipped her nail while she was getting the vodka out of the toilet. No different. But the people that I work with today in my recovery are drunk drivers. And God has spent 48 years of my life kind of manipulating me to be where I'm at today. When I was working as a vet tech in my recovery, I thrived on crisis, and God used my skills as a rescuer and person thriving on crisis to be a good vet tech at an emergency hospital. Because of my codependency, I needed to retire because I get emotionally invested. Some of you understand what I'm talking about with that. But my recovery in all 25 years have been blessed, and I have had some really crazy people that I let into my life during that time, and still have some crazy people in my life because of that recovery. But I trust that God has, from the day that I finally hit reality, I trust that God has been working on me for just today. He's not working on me for some miraculous thing I'm going to do in the future, like President Aurora, whatever. He's working on me for today. And what was important for me today, as you can tell while you're listening to me, I didn't want to think about what I was going to come in and share today as far as sharing my 25 years of recovery. I wanted to come here and be in the moment and be in the day. And this is where I'm at. And riding the roller coaster with me, this is what my recovery is like on a daily basis. Some days are better than others, but this is it. This is what Laura has learned to achieve and accomplish and be in recovery. And I see some familiar faces, and I like that. I like seeing some familiar faces. Some people in here that are really special to me. And the ones that I've seen throughout the years, sometimes you'll see somebody in meetings for a long time, and then all of a sudden they're gone. And you start thinking about where they went and what happened. Oh, they must have relapsed. That's not always true. They find other places to share their recovery, and they find other places to achieve their recovery. And you follow that path. Do the next indicated thing means a lot in recovery. It really does. Breathe in, breathe out. Put one foot in front of the other, and do the next indicated thing. And if it's uncomfortable in your gut in the beginning, good. Because if it's something that's a new behavior, try it. Because I'm sitting here with colored socks on, and 25 years ago, I'd have never wore colored socks. So Well, I'm not the person that I would have imagined 25 years ago. I would not. I would have been sitting here barefooted in my overalls. But you can truly in recovery be anybody you want to be. And when I turned myself into jail, walking down that ramp at the old Tulare County Maine, I remember telling myself, today is the first day of the rest of my life. And I remember believing that. And those tools that they offer in these meetings and some of the stupid-ass sayings that you hear, those are the tools. You say them until you hear them, and then you say them a little bit longer, and then you'll live them. And those things become a part of who you are. And that's the Alcoholics Anonymous language of the heart. People share. They don't just talk. People believe. And then they live. And one of the hardest things to accomplish when you come into recovery is that you have to learn how to behave. That's not completely true. You just learn how to adjust it so that it's a little more accepting to those around you that you affect, because you are the example. This is what recovery is like today. And if you're just a squirrely son of a bitch, that's what your recovery looks like today. Because there's some people who have some health issues, mental, emotional, physical, all that. Today's all you got. And I think maybe I got it this time. I'm not going to give a chance to ask questions. my first year of recovery, I was in jail. My second year of recovery, I was living at a ranch. The house came with the job. I was driving, at that time, a Caterpillar, eating dirt. I smoked cigarettes, so I had a pack of Kool in one pocket and a pack of Marlboro in the other pocket. Because when you're driving a Caterpillar and you're eating all that dirt, when you're driving in the direction that the dirt's blowing over you, you smoke a Kool, and it's easier to suck in all that dirt in that cigarette. These are things that you have to learn to accommodate your addictions. And then when you're driving the other way, and the dirt's, and it's, the air's wonderful, you smoke a Marlboro, and you enjoy it. And then when you get off work, you go to meetings. I went for the first years of my recovery, and I lived out there on the ranch. I didn't drive for 3 years. They took my driver's license because I was a chronic drunk driver. They revoked my driver's license, my ability to be on the road with you. So I didn't have a license for 3 years. But I made a meeting every day, every night, sometimes twice. Sometimes the foreman would take me, him and his wife would take me to lunch, a noon meeting. But I made meetings every day. There were people that were in my life that would come out there, weren't even in the community as far as AA. They would come out there and pick me up, take me to a meeting, and come back and pick me up and take me back home. They'd come out, pick me up, take me grocery shopping. They would never take anything in return for that because they wanted me to get better. They really wanted me to get better. And they were just friends, and friends of friends. And they helped me to stay plugged in. But I stayed out that ranch, sitting on that tractor, driving back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth all day long. And I would get off work, and I would make it to a meeting covered in diesel and dirt and sit next to anybody, and they didn't care. As long as I was there, they'd hug me, they didn't care. As long as I was there, they didn't care. Then I started working on Tuesdays at the sales yard in Tulare, the livestock sales yard, where I was coming covered in hog shit, goat shit, pig shit, and sheep shit, and whatever shit. They'd sit in meetings and flick the little chips of shit off of me. And they didn't care as long as I got there. I went to the Tuesday night Keep It Simple group. Nobody was called on. You could share if you wanted to or not. So a lot of car carriers showed up at that meeting. And that was my home group for years. And I'd come in there wearing my cowboy hat with all the little disgusting hat pins on it. And I would hide under it. I didn't realize that you could actually hide under your hat. Until somebody one day said they noticed it when certain people would share in the meetings, I'd flip my hat up and I'd listen. And then when they were done talking, I'd pull it back down again and fuck it out, you know? And I would try to hide in the very back of the meeting so that nobody would call on me, you know? But I'd sit back there in the very back of the meeting with my cowboy hat. So somebody would go, I'm not sure if the person wore that cowboy hat back there. So I couldn't hide in that meeting with the stupid hat, so I quit wearing it. But for those of you that wear hats, sometimes you hide under them. Just bump it up a little bit, let somebody in, bump it down, you should be closing out. I still have my cowboy hat sitting on my closet on the shelf so I could see it with all its disgusting little pins and stuff, because that was a major part of who I was when I first got here. And I made a major decision at 5 years, 6 years clean and sober to leave that job at the ranch, and I took a job in Solaria at the Fisto, Harmon Bone, whatever. I worked there for a year, and the transition of my recovery was trying to, at that point, finally building the deposit for the utilities, and do I get a phone or not, because all that stuff had been supplied when I lived at the ranch. And I lived there for a year in Visalia, and what happened was, when you're an active member of the 12-step community and you're in a high-profile area where people drive by all the time, they stop by all the time, and your house becomes social. So I went from 2 miles of dirt road to get to my house, nobody just drops by out there. So living on a high-profile area, and people wouldn't go away. But I did have a wonderful year of experience with people there, actively participating in recovery. Then I moved to Lemon Cove, where I live now. I've lived up there for about 19 years now. And people don't just drop by up there now. But I work in Hanford and Corcoran, and I live in Lemon Cove, and I tell people the reason I do that is because I can go home. Because it's beautiful where I'm at. And I have a safe place, a safe environment. And during my recovery, I have achieved a few animals. And so I have an area where I can have the animals and be safe, relatively safe. I still, in my recovery, have a strong commitment to meetings. During the last few years, I got to where I kind of backed off a little bit. I didn't go to as many. And a lot of that was because I was getting close to people and they were dying. And for a lot of different reasons. I mean, you know, you get older, people die. It happens. But it's kind of like that funnel effect. A lot of people settle at the bottom, and they're all close, and then a few die, and a few fall out. And that's kind of how it works. But this process in actively living in my recovery, my first sponsor told me one of the things about my story that I can't share, because I would get way too emotional, and it would be the loss of animals that I had in my recovery, or in my use. And my first sponsor told me that God took your animals so you could learn to love people. So for the first 2 years, I didn't have any animals. And no, I didn't do it like 28 days, but, you know, that was before 28 days came out, the movie. But I did have plants. My sponsor told me to get plants, so I did. And they were like, whoa, you know. And then I got a cat, and his name was Bullet. And his name was Bullet because if he didn't get through it, I had something with his name on it. And then I got a dog, and he lived to be about 16 and a half years. And he was Arcanon. A lot of people that were in the community, they knew Otter. But for those of you that get out on your own and start participating in your own life and recovery, having an animal is an obligation, a commitment, and a responsibility, just like your recovery is, an obligation, responsibility, and a commitment. And if you get a pet, you're looking at least 17 years. So consider, in fact, if you make a commitment to recovery, you look at least 17 years and then decide if you want to go out in it. Not bad. Things that you have to do, maintenance of it, there are things you need to do during your recovery. And I will say, recently my sponsor fired me. My sponsor fired me because she's not going to come back to the States. She's been over in Africa and Australia for the last few years and was planning on coming back. And about 2 weeks ago, she said, we're not coming back. We're going to end up in Kenya, and we're not coming back. So you probably ought to get another sponsor. And I'm, like, devastated. But so we need a sponsor. And I am one of those people that believe that a female should have a female sponsor and a male should have a male sponsor. But as far as people that I've sponsored whoever needs a sponsor. So I'm a hypocrite. But I do need to find a female sponsor, and my requirements for a sponsor is this. I need to be able to trust you. Bottom line. I need to be able to trust you. I'm not looking for volunteers tonight, I'm just saying that out loud. because the best way for me to keep myself honest and stay out of my secrets is to say it out loud so that you know my secret too. You drive down the road and you see a beer can and your mouth waters, you tell whoever you're riding with, that just made my mouth water, and they think you're crazy as shit, and you are. But say it out loud and you go on and you don't keep it secret. It doesn't haunt you that night when you wake up and you're sweating and thinking, man, I'm thirsty, and it was fucking Coors, you know? I didn't drink that shit. And I apologize for all of those that get offended by a lady using the F-bomb, the G-bomb, and the D-bomb, and the whatever bomb, but I'm going to do it. There are places and times that I won't, but tonight's not one of those. I say it because I feel it, and if I'm lazy when I say fuck, then, you know, I'm not lazy when I do it. So, if I'm gonna... Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.